If you have your Bibles with you or a phone with you that has a Bible on it, I would get you to turn to John chapter 3. And we're going to work through this story together, because in this story, John, the gospel writer, he brings you and I, the reader, to a place where it exposes Nicodemus. It brings him to the most awkward, most vulnerable kind of moment of his life. It's that moment, and some of you might know this feeling, it's that moment when you are convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that you are right, only to be informed by, oftentimes, my wife, that I'm dead wrong. That all of my leaning in, all of my understanding, all of my kind of behavior is shaped by certain things, and then have Amy say something very gracefully, well, no, that's not actually true. And then to be exposed to be in that space of like, oh, yeah, it's not at all. Like, and that a very, very vulnerable spot. This is where John, the gospel reader, brings us with Nicodemus. And let's get started together this morning. In this story, there is a man named Nicodemus. Nicodemus has heard some of the amazing things that Jesus has been doing. And no doubt the water to wine story that we looked at last week is just one of the many things that Nicodemus has heard Jesus do. And out of a space of, I would like to talk with this particular man who is doing some pretty amazing things, I want to chat with him. John tells us that Nicodemus viewed Jesus to be someone who is very, very special and knew there was something unique about him. We'll throw this verse up on the screen. This is how John records Nicodemus's words around who Jesus was. He says this, "We know that you are a teacher who has come from God, for no one could perform the signs you were doing if God were not with him." And this is the reason why. This is the catalyst for Nicodemus seeking out Jesus, kind of under the cover of night, to have a conversation about life and about salvation. And we'll stop here for a moment, because what I find fascinating about this scene of Nicodemus coming to Jesus really is a picture of all of us as human beings. People then, like Nicodemus, people now, like you and I, know that for the most part, Jesus is different. The church has done awful things for the last 2,000 years, and it is a miracle that people still are intrigued by the person of Jesus Christ. There is this inquiry that exists in all of us as we get to hear of the stories. It's like that person who has never heard of why we celebrate Christmas, and they discover, what? Like, there's a baby, and his name is Jesus, and this is why this whole thing happens? Or Easter time, when someone who grows up in an environment where they have no idea why Good Friday is celebrated, and they discover there was a guy who was killed on a cross, and that's why, even to this day, in a post-Christian era, there's a stat holiday on Good Friday. Like, there's a leaning in to inquire of, well, who is this man? Who is this man? It was then, it was now, and listen, it's always going to be this way. So, I know that sometimes we kind of watch the news, and there's this great effort to kind of remove Jesus from the landscape. Listen, despite all of culture's best efforts to remove him, they're not going to remove him. He's always going to be present. He's always going to be this unique figure in the historical landscape that invites questions of people like we see here with Nicodemus. And we go to him and we inquire of him about life and what he had to say. And for the most part, people actually enjoy 90% of what he has to say. And unbeknownst to them, practice what he says without even knowing they're practicing what he says. And yet there's more to it that we'll get into here in a little bit moment. Let's go back into the story. Jesus responds to Nicodemus's questions by saying this. It's up on the screen. Jesus comes back to him and says, very truly I tell you, no one can see the kingdom of God unless they are born again. And this phrase, born again, throws a wrench into Nicodemus's thinking. He has no idea what Jesus is talking about, and it kind of struggles there. If you read John 3, where he's like I gotta climb back up in my mother's womb. Like I'm 6'2", 250 on a good day, and like that's a weird space. Like, how does that happen? In fact, if Nicodemus had kind of your phone, he would ask Siri, like, born again. And Siri would respond, I don't know what you mean. Like, it would just be kind of a weird kind of conversation, being unsure of what it is that Jesus is in fact talking about. You can tell that this throws Nicodemus off because Jesus comes back to him and says, "You should not be surprised at my saying you must be born again." So here in this moment, out of love for Nicodemus, Jesus is completely dismantling his understanding of life and salvation. And before we get into the specifics of that, I want to highlight who Nicodemus is to you. Some of you know this. You've kind of grown up in church. You've heard this story 100 times. And that's going to be the reason why it's harder for you to hear sometimes these stories. And then there's other of you here this morning, you don't know who Nicodemus is. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about this man. Nicodemus was a Pharisee. He was a teacher of the law. He belonged to what we would call the conservative party of first century Judaism. He was a middle class man, and Pharisees were known to be incredibly smart, shrewd, kind of Kevin O'Leary businessmen. I know that invokes all kinds of things, but that's not what I meant to do that. This meant, because of his place, he was in kind of constant conversation with kind of regular folk like you and I. Like, he would have been around them. They would have known his name. He would have been a well-liked guy in his time, in his place, in his culture. And because of the role of Pharisee, people admired him. People aspired to be like him in many ways. Nicodemus was a guy who strictly followed the Torah, which is kind of the big five, the first five books of the Old Testament: Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Chances are he knew them all inside and out, along with the Psalms and Proverbs and other kind of writings that mattered a lot to Jewish people in the first century. Nicodemus was someone who was really, really good at being outwardly moral. This was a big part of his life, as it was connected to following all the laws in the Old Testament, all 613 of them. I had like five in my house growing up, and I couldn't do those five well. And he knew all 613, and by and large knew them, practiced them in his life. And if you stop and think about Nicodemus's kind of allegiance to the law and practicing what he was taught through the law, that is very much us. It might not be a Jewish law that we follow, but there are some beliefs that you practice that have come from somewhere. It could be your home. You grew up in just a home where your mom and dad just taught you the basic things of right and wrong that were good and bad, and you have just kind of perpetuated that in your life as a late teen, as an early 20, now you're married, and you're kind of following these set of rules that you got from your mom and dad, and you're not even really sure why you follow them, but you follow them. Some of you said, "I'm not going to do anything like my mom and dad taught me, because they taught me something I don't believe in." So we went out and sought something new. And we, you know, spent some time with Oprah, spent some time with a whole bunch of other people. And we laugh. It's true. Like, the reason why she is such a huge influence in the world is because people believe her and practice. And hopefully they're there on the day where they're, it's not like Oprah's favorite things, and they just kind of leave home and their whole world has changed for at least the next 8 days, because they have a lot of new toys. But we run after things that we then take on as to be, yes, this is true, this is why I live my life. And if you don't believe me, spend an afternoon watching the little Facebook memes that we put out there. All kinds of things. An old friend from high school that we kind of reconnected through Facebook. It's weird. Like, we haven't been friends in 30 years. And I'm like, "Oh yeah, we're friends." I'm like, "No, we're not friends. Like, we haven't seen each other in 30 years. And yet, kind of watching their little kind of poems that they put up, I'm like, this is their Nicodemus law. This is what they lean into. Put positive energy out into the universe and you'll get it back. And they believe this and follow this just like Nicodemus is doing with the Jewish law. We all do this in a variety of ways. We all do this in one way or another. And this is the means by which we determine whether or not we are good people. By virtue of my work, I spend time with people as they move close to death, and then bury them, and then spend time preparing funerals, gravesides, and those kinds of moments. Very tender moments, and moments where you discover what people actually believe about death and life and the afterlife. You want to find out what someone believes, marry them and bury them. It's amazing the things that come out of the woodwork. It really is amazing. And someone, in most funerals that I'm a part of, in one way or another, there's this kind of philosophical, they were a good person. And sometimes I'm like, did you know them? Like, you know, there's that kind of moment of like, you're talking about someone that I knew well, and this is not at all my memory of them. And yet, they spoke their mind as if that's a noble trait. With me, you know what you get? Speak my mind. That's not good. That's not a good thing. That's normally someone who's ignorant, rude. There's a variety of qualities that go along with someone who I just speak my mind. And there's all kinds of things. But yet they followed their way of life all the way to the grave, and someone at the funeral says they were good. God will let them in, because if they don't get in, I don't know who ever would. And this is kind of the narrative around how we practice Nicodemus-like living in 21st century life. It's not Old Testament law, but it's some philosophy that drives you, and you do this well, as if this is where great life comes from and ultimately what will save us in the life to come. Nicodemus, Jesus, in this moment, Jesus begins to destroy his kind of thinking. And with this context around who Nicodemus is as a first century Pharisee, Jesus begins to reshape his understanding of what real life is and about salvation in life and the life to come. And to help Nicodemus kind of work through these things that Jesus has already said, namely the whole phrase kind of born again, Jesus mashes two historical events together that Nicodemus would know about. I'm going to put them up on the screen, and it's verses 14 and 15. This is Jesus to Nicodemus. Just as Moses lifted up the snake in the wilderness, so the Son of Man must be lifted up, that everyone who believes may have eternal life. Now, in this moment, we read it and we're like, I don't know what that means. Truth be told, I did not know what this meant. I've grown up in church. I've probably missed 25 Sundays in my entire life, and I'm like, snakes in the wilderness? What is this story about? And you have to go find this story. It's like three verses in Numbers. And if you know Numbers, you're like, oh, that's why I don't know the story. Because it's in a book that nobody reads. It's like Genesis, Exodus. We're like, we're making great headway. We get into Leviticus and we're like, this is ridiculous. And we never get to Numbers because we bail halfway through Leviticus because it's just so not where we are in life. So in this story, the snakes in the wilderness, and the Son of Man, Jesus points to these things, but Nicodemus knows them very, very well. He's a Pharisee from the first century. He knows these moments. So to help you figure out how Jesus is dismantling Nicodemus's kind of thinking around life and living and the life to come, I want to walk you through very quickly these two moments. Moment one is kind of the snake in the wilderness moment. Nicodemus knows that God's people, after they left Egypt, after God saved them, Israel turned their back on God. Months after God brought them out of slavery, after he had been feeding them every day enough food to get by, God tells Moses to tell his people to go this way, and Israel says, no, we're not going that way. We're going to go our own way. And they complain, and they grumble, and they say things like, at least in Egypt we had wine and we had meat. They neither had wine nor meat. But when we complain, we create a narrative of what it was that's not at all reflective of actually what it was. We remember things better than they really were, and this is going on in the nation of Israel's life. And God, to deal with his children like a loving parent would deal with their kids, God sends snakes into the camp to punish them, to turn them away from where they're going so they would go to where God is trying to bring them. And these snakes were poisonous snakes. And you're like, well, as a loving parent, I don't really do that. Well, then you haven't had kids yet, because there's times where that's an option. Like, there's times where I'm like, where's that snake? I would love to have a snake right now. But anyway, God sends snakes into the camp. They bite the Israelites, and because of this poison, after days go by, they die. And you're like, that's a mean God. Well, no. It's actually trying to drive his people to a space of life. But they think they know where life is. to get them out of that predicament, God says, here's snakes, and here's how you avoid death because of the snakes. Moses, take some copper, make a snake from that copper, and put it on a giant pole in the middle of the camp. And someone who gets bit by the snakes, to live and to trust me, they just have to look at the snake. All they have to do is just look at the snake. And the Israelites, who by faith believed what Moses was saying, found their loved ones who were dying, brought them to this moment, kind of look at the snake, and God healed them in this way. So Jesus tells Nicodemus, just like Moses lifted up the snake, so the Son of Man must be lifted up. And that's the other phrase that he points Nicodemus to, the Son of Man moment, and that's the second one. Nicodemus knows that God has promised his people that there's going to be a Messiah coming that's going to change the entire world, change the entire way in which we live. And Nicodemus knows the words of the prophet Daniel from hundreds of years before. And I'm going to read to you what Nicodemus instantly triggers when he hears Jesus say the phrase, the Son of Man. This is the phrase. This is out of Daniel chapter 7. In my vision, this is Daniel speaking, in my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a Son of Man, coming in the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days, that's God the Father himself. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshiped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. And I want you to understand the weight of this moment in Nicodemus' life, because this takes us to that place of being awkward and vulnerable and discovering that you're wrong when you thought you were entirely right. Jesus has just claimed to Nicodemus, a Pharisee, a follower of God manifested through the law, Jesus has just claimed, I am the one that Daniel was talking about. The one that you're looking for is standing right in front of you. And I have been given all authority, all glory, all sovereign power, and every person will worship me. Daniel, or Nicodemus, is confronted with the Son of Man that Daniel has prophesied, and Jesus is claiming, I am this one. And listen to what I'm saying, Nicodemus, because all of your understanding of life is wrong. Well-intended, but dead wrong. Jesus, in an effort to help him understand what matters in life, what matters in the life to come, Jesus has just told him, I am the Son of Man, and I'm going to be lifted up just like the snake was. And for you to live your life apart from me is nothing but death in this life and the life to come. Nicodemus, Jesus is telling him, to be born again means you must believe this. You must believe that I am who I say I am. And in it, you will find life. Outside of it, you will experience nothing but death. We jump down to verse 19 in John 3. This is the moment of completely being exposed, of completely coming to the place of being vulnerable, that moment where you think you are so right and only to discover that you are dead wrong. I had one of these moments in my own life this past week. Last Saturday, I booked our family vacation in North Conway. We love going to North Conway. It's a day's drive. There are all kinds of things to do. And as our kids get older, it's like there's a whole new layer of activities that we can do with our family, because now they can walk and hike and do all these kinds of things, whereas before it was kind of like they were in strollers and cribs and we couldn't do that. So it's just a place in the world that just kind of keeps on giving into our family time. But it's getting harder and harder and harder through these certificates that we use to get to this place. There was a resort that came online. My brother called me. It's all, like, go and book your place. I booked my place and I went to bed last Saturday night very excited. We were going to North Conway with our family, with my brother, with his kids, with our kid, and it's just a great time. Sunday morning, woke up, I was feeling great, did church, feeling great, went home, was thinking about that again, and you're like, you love time away? Yeah, I do. And we were thinking about that, talking about it, called my brother again about things we could do, Sunday night, went to bed, watched some football games, the teams I'd hoped for won. Monday morning, I was just through the moon. Like, May is like 13 weeks away, and it's getting closer. And Pam, unbeknownst to her, in staff meeting, says Caroline was looking to book the wedding for the church for a wedding in July. Do you think there's anything kind of going on in there? I'm like, no, I don't think so. That phrase struck into my mind, heart, that was awful. Something about that wedding phrase was like, there's something wrong here. I don't know what it is, but I know it conflicts with my vacation that I've just booked, that I'm pretty excited about. I pull up my day timer, I go and look at it, I'm like, nope. And there it was, right in the middle of my now non-refundable vacation was a wedding that I'm officiating at the long weekend of May, Simon and Shannon's wedding. And I was dead wrong. I thought I had nailed this. And my first thought was, I wonder if they'll move their wedding. And then I said, no, I can't do that. Now, that moment of you were dead wrong. This is Nicodemus, only it's on a much grander scale. A much grander scale from just double booking yourself from vacation. And I want to paint this picture for you that you might feel the weight of this moment for Nicodemus in his life. Nicodemus, a Jewish man, a religious leader, a teacher of the law, a law follower, someone who is outwardly impeccably moral. Impeccably moral. A person who is admired by his peers, admired by common people, someone who is sought after for counsel and advice in life and living, a person who knows and follows all 613 laws, a person who is thought to have figured out life and living in salvation, is told by Jesus, and this is in verse 19, we'll put it up on the screen. This is Jesus speaking to Nicodemus. This is the verdict. Light has come into the world, but people loved darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil. Jesus is saying to Nicodemus, using the imagery of light and darkness, your entire life, Nicodemus, is built on darkness, and all your deeds are evil. The Son of Man has just told you, despite your best efforts, all your deeds are evil. The verdict is in. As of right now, you're guilty. You're standing outside of what real life is. You're standing outside of what salvation is. This is the most vulnerable place that you and I can ever find ourselves in. Nicodemus, that would have been a terrible moment for him. Now, what's interesting about this moment is we bring it into our context, and it's still true. If Jesus is here this morning having this conversation with us all, he would say the same thing. He would say, unless you believe that I am the Son of Man who has now been lifted up, like the cross is in the rearview mirror. We know about Calvary. We know about Resurrection Sunday. This is now in the rearview mirror. Unless you believe I am this one, there is nothing but death in your life, and there's nothing but tragic death at your death. Most of us this morning who are here, we have felt the sting of this death all the time. It's like those Israelites who are kind of bitten by the snake that are slowly dying. Well, we are bitten by a curse. It's called sin and death in the world. And we feel its sting every single day. When we have conversations of God, we are aware that our relationship with God is not quite how it should be. And we're uncomfortable in the conversation. We tend to run away from God. It's odd. At weddings and funerals, there's many people, particularly men, who will come through the door. They'll pause, and they're like, whew, like I thought I was going to burst into flames here. And they are uncomfortable with the idea of being in the presence of God. This is a result of sin and death in people's hearts and minds. We feel the sting of sin and death, the curse at play in our earthly relationships. All of us here this morning all of us here this morning have someone in our life, either right now or someone in our past, that relationship was great and awesome, and now it's not. And for some of us, we don't even know why that is. Nothing happened that we're aware of. We didn't change. But for one reason or another, because of the curse, that relationship is over. We feel it getting played out in our life in one way or another. For many of us here this morning, if not all of us at some point in our life, we are uncomfortable with who we are. There's something that kind of goes on inside of us where we worry and we experience anxiety and fear and depression and self-esteem. All of these things get worked into our lives because of the curse that we are in fact under and experience all of our lives. And Jesus says to Nicodemus, and he says to you and I, to be born again, to experience a different kind of life, to experience a salvation that's different from what you think is going to save you, you must believe that I am the Son of Man. You must believe that I am the Christ. Jesus, the Son of Man, to Nicodemus and to you and I, gently says, all your efforts to experience life, all your efforts to save yourself and be good, they amount to nothing. They amount to nothing. And if we are being worked on by the Holy Spirit when this moment comes, like the Spirit was with Nicodemus, we can find ourselves in this incredibly vulnerable space of all my effort, all my thinking, all my beliefs have just been exposed by the Son of Man, and we're terrified in that vulnerable moment. And this is one of the greatest verses that we read over, because we know its more famous cousin, John 3:16, but we don't know John 3:17. It's in this vulnerable moment where Jesus says to Nicodemus, in the vulnerable space, he says this, it's up on the screen, Nicodemus, God did not send his Son, me, into the world to condemn the world, to condemn you, Nicodemus, but to save you through me. Whoever believes in me is not condemned, but whoever does not believe stands condemned already, because they have not believed in the name of God's one and only Son. I want to stop here for a moment and work through just very quickly this little phrase that says, believes in. You need to know this. Satan, the demons, they believe that Jesus is God's Son. So what Jesus is saying to you and I is, it's not the same thing. Like, our handling of Jesus has to be different than what the demons acknowledge to be true. It's more than just you and I saying, I believe in God. No, that's not what he's after. That's not what he's leaning into. Jesus defines what this means later on in John's Gospel that we'll get to. But I want to read to you three quick passages where Jesus helps us understand the weight behind the phrase, believe in me. This is John 14:15 is where you'll find these passages, where Jesus says, whoever believes in me will do what I say. Whoever believes in me will do what I say. He says, if you love me, you will keep my commands. Anyone who loves me will follow my instructions. Believe in Jesus Christ is far more than some rational kind of agreement that, yeah, I can get on with this. I can believe that Jesus is the Son of God. Believing in him is that I would do what he said, that I would do what he says. And here's the reason why we just should. If we believe that Jesus is the Son of God, if we believe that he's God, if we believe he's the Son of Man, if we believe all the titles that the Scriptures say he is, that he's been given all authority, which means authority over your life and mine, if he's been given all glory, if he truly is the one that is powerful over all of the nations of the world, if that all people will gather and bow down and worship, if he really is this guy and we believe this to be true, when he says something about life, Why do we second guess it? I believe you are the most greatest, most powerful man in the world, but I don't think you know anything about my wallet. Okay. Okay. It's like something's not right here. I believe that all people will worship you, but I don't think you know how I should forgive my mother. Like, there's things in here where if Jesus says something, if I believe he is all that he is, we lean into it by faith and do it. Because he's right. But what we do is we bring him down from the office that he rightfully has, and his voice becomes one of about four or five that we listen to. Well, Jesus says this, Oprah says this, Dr. Phil says this. Dr. Phil wins today. Who's Dr. Phil? He's just an old bald guy, and soon that will be me. He's just some guy who's as messed up as you are, as messed up as I am. And for whatever reason, on that particular day, he wins when it comes to your heart and what will give you the greatest sense of life here and what's to come at the expense of the Son of God who has demonstrated a great love for you. The final moment I want to bring you to, the final question is kind of why Jesus exposes Nicodemus, brings him to the vulnerable place. He comes alongside him in that vulnerable moment of, I have not come to condemn you, Nicodemus. I've come to save you from this dilemma that you're in. And that final question is, well, why would he do this? Why would Jesus do this? Why would God provide a way out for the Nicodemuses of the world? I want you with me to say the greatest verse that you probably know. For some of you, this might be your only verse that you know. The driving reason for why is, say with me, for God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him will not perish, but have everlasting life. Jesus, out of love for Nicodemus, exposes him, not to condemn him, but to save him. Why? Because he loves him. Watch the screen and hear from himself.